introduce our main speaker for this evening, Melody from San Diego.
Good evening. My name's Melody. I'm an alcoholic. And I just want to say it's an honor and privilege to be here tonight and just kind of come out and share. I haven't done this a lot lately, so I'm not a circuit speaker by any means. And I've been told I can't cuss from the podium, so I'm going to try really, really hard. It's not my gut instinct is always to have the F word come out, and I've been taught in AA to act better than I feel, so I will try to adhere to that. Nick, you were fabulous. And I'm sorry that you had 10 minutes. I was going to give you 15 of mine because you were so good. And I know how it is. 10 minutes, you're just into being drunk, and all of a sudden you have to have 1 minute left. You're like, and I got sober. And happy birthday to the birthday people, Nick and Ben. Congratulations. It's a big deal. Any year in sobriety is an amazing thing, because we are, just so you know, we're just skimming the surface. As many people as you see in here tonight, there are probably hundreds more out there dying of this disease. So we are the lucky and the fortunate ones. And if you're new to Alcoholics Anonymous, I welcome you. I hope you found what I have found. This is the best deal in town. I absolutely love Alcoholics Anonymous. I happen to be a little cheerleader at my meetings for Alcoholics Anonymous because I really love it. It has given me a way of life that is far exceeds the life that I had before. And was it TC?
Yes.
Congratulations on 90 days. 90 days is a big deal. If you can do 90 days, you can do anything. So just keep going, okay? Love you. The last time I came here, Ken D was speaking, and I absolutely adore him, and he was really funny. I really enjoyed him. He said one of those things from the podium that I absolutely love. He says, I'm not nuts, but I'm nuts. And I can tell you this, in my sobriety today, I am not the nuts that I came in here with, but I am nut today. And that means I'm not all the way nuts, but I'm still a little crazy. And I got sober on April 4th, 1984, and counting down, that is 27 years, and I am forever grateful to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I got sober when I was 24. I'm going to be 52 this year. And you know what? I wouldn't have lived probably another year if I didn't get sober. So how they tell us, it's you share what it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. I was born in 1959. I grew up in the 60s. In the 60s, people were drinking and smoking pot. That's what we did. And I come from an alcoholic family. I'm going to share about my father a little bit because my father is a big part of my alcoholism. He was an alcoholic too. And from the get-go, him and I couldn't get along. From the get-go, we were doing this. I said no to him whenever he talked to me. And I don't know where that resentment came from. I know that as a little kid, my dad never picked me up. And the first year that I was alive, my father had TB, and he was in the Balboa Naval for a full year trying to recover from TB. And so he didn't see me. My mother would go out and kind of hold me up to the window, and, you know, he would wave or whatever. But he didn't really hold me. And when I got a little bit older, 2 and 3, I didn't understand why my father never held me. And I didn't understand what was wrong with me. And so our relationship was really hard. And then when I was old enough, I knew something was wrong with my father. When I was 4, he would have beers all over the house, and he would get mad really fast. I mean, he would just fly off the handle. And I knew something was odd and something was different, and I had to protect myself, and I didn't know how to do that. So I hid a lot in my room, and whenever he was in the house, I wouldn't be in the room that he was in, and that kind of carried on through many years. I took my first drink when I was 4 because that's what my dad had on the, you know, he had Budweiser. And so I liked the bubbles. I thought it tasted pretty good. I thought, this is not too bad. You know, I didn't get drunk. Nothing, no problem there. But I had a cigarette that he had, you know, thrown outside, and I went and I had a little smoke on that at 4. So I'm this little kid taking a beer and smoking a cigarette at 4. I don't know what 4 years old are doing today. I don't see him doing that though. So I was a little odd. And then, you know, soon after that, my mother found me under the bunk beds, and I had some Chiclets that I had stolen from the store. And she says, "What are you doing under there?" And I'm like, "Nothing." And she said, "Did you take something from the store?" No. She said, yes, you did. We're going to go back and you have to give it back to the store. That's the type of person my mother is. And so, of course, I took about, you know, I don't know, maybe 15 or 20 Chiclets out because I'm not taking them all back. He ain't getting them all back. And so I took them back. I had to apologize. So I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief from a very young age. And that carried on into adulthood. And, you know, as I grew up, I was around neighbors that, you know, it was like, you know, the 60s and 70s, and people were drinking. And I had neighbors that were older than me that were high school, and they were drinking, and I wanted to hang out with them. And I just didn't feel comfortable at my house. My mother worked from the time I was two, so we would get off, and we would come home from school, and, you know, and I was growing up without a lot of parental guidance. I remember, I'm from San Diego, moved away for 10 years in L.A., but I'm from San Diego, and I don't know if you remember the Payday movie that Bob Dale did every day. He's dead, so I can say that. But I would watch the old movies, and I wanted to be Katharine Hepburn. I wanted to be Katharine Hepburn, and I wanted to be Anne Margaret, and I wanted to be, you know, all of the old actresses that are out there. You know, I idolized what they were doing, and I lived in this fantasy world that someday I was going to be like that. And you know, the people on the street, the older people that were drinking alcohol, we had a park up the street, and I would go up, and I would hang out up with them. My brother was 2 years older than me, and he was smoking pot, and I would go up to the park, and, you know, I wanted to be in. I wanted to feel like I fit in somewhere. And I've always felt like I didn't fit in. I've always felt like I've been this alien from another planet. I don't know if you've ever done this drunk or sober, but you go out and you look up at the stars and you say, someday they're coming back for me. Someday. Someday it's going to come and that door is going to open and I'm going to be home. You know, and that's how I lived most of my life, you know. And the first time I took a drink and I got drunk, man, I was there. I was flying through the galaxy and I was okay and I was going home. And that's just how I grew up. And I don't know how that is for you, but that's my story. And that's the only one I can give you tonight. It's my story. Get your own, as they say. You know, and all of you guys have one here, and I can't wait to hear all of your stories someday from the podium. I hope you get to be a speaker someday. And I guess it took me 27 years to get to here today. But that's, you know, you stay sober and you get to speak. A lot of times my dad would be passed out on the couch and some money would fall out of his wallet like a 20, you know, and when you're 8 years old, $20 is like $1 million. And so I would run up to the park and I'd go, I got $20, and they would go over and somebody would buy a six pack or two, or in those days, I think you could buy a case with a $20 bill, and they'd come back to the park and we'd all be drinking and stuff. And I was in, I was like, they would pat me on the head and I was cool. They thought I was okay. You know, and I really lived for stuff like that. And I kept growing up, and my dad kept drinking. And one time he got in a fight with a neighbor. You know, this young kid said something to him like, back off, daddy. You know, and my dad took this kid down. You know, I'm screaming, running into the house, saying, dad's fighting with this kid in the neighborhood. And my mom's like, oh, no, not again. So, you know, she goes out there, and I'm all embarrassed. And for a week or 3 weeks or a month, whatever, I wouldn't come out because my dad had beat up a kid in the neighborhood. And today, I kind of respect that. You know, these old guys, you know, when this kid smart mouths them, you know, it's like, listen, 15-year-old, I'll show you, you know. And, you know, now I kind of respect my dad. My father passed away 2 years ago, and I'll talk about that in a little bit. But I love my dad very, very much. But I felt very separate from him. And when we would eat dinner at the dinner table, there was no talking, because that's how my dad was. You just didn't talk. And as a little girl, I was talking all the time. You know, little kids are like, well, no, look at the color on the walls. And, oh, Lord, can you see what's on TV? And what are we doing in school? And, you know, and I was just talking, and my dad just didn't approve of it. And so I was told that I couldn't talk, and I had a really hard time with that. So most of the time, I was saying things like, oh, I can't say that from the podium. You bleepity bleep bleep. And then I'd get you know, I'd have to go into the living room because I wasn't allowed to cuss in the dinner table. And then I'd get my way. I'd be at the, you know, in the back living room watching TV in my own little world. And, you know, I had drinking during that time. You know, I had taken some beers with some friends up at the park and stuff like that. But it wasn't until I started smoking pot and doing some of the other things that we were doing in the 70s. Like, have you ever put airplane glue in a plastic bag and put it over your nose and inhale and drink beer at the same time? Well, one time I woke up in the morning in the canyon. And I had ants coming out my nose. And it was just, those are the type of insane things I was doing at 12 and 13 and 14. And my mother, we had one of these campers shells that was in the front yard, you know, in the driveway. And we would sleep in that. And it was the big weekend thing. I'm like, I'm sleeping in the camper. And my mother, I mean, still to this day, my mother goes, I don't know where I went wrong. I don't know. You know, she goes, I was so oblivious to everything. And I said, you were just, your mom, you were never an alcoholic. You didn't do stuff like this. My mother's the type of person that she takes a half of a margarita and she goes, I'm feeling this, I better stop. And I'm like, well, that's the point, you know. If you feel that with a half, you should go for 10. You should see what 10 feels like. And that, I always drank like that. I've never wanted a glass of wine in my life. I mean, the other night at work, one girl, we were having a really busy night, and this one girl was like, you know, this is one of those nights you want to go home and have a bottle of wine. I'm like, what? I said, a bottle of wine, this is a threer. This is tonight, it's a threer, you know. And I would drink three bottles of wine when I would come home from work from waitressing sometimes, you know. It was like, it was a rough night. Somebody pissed me off, and to get back with him, you know, I'm going to drink. And I'm going to drink three or four, whatever it was, you know. And that's how I drank. And, you know, so I did some drugs in the 70s. You know, I had a neighbor across the street that we used to hang out with, and her sister was a little bit older. She was like 21 or 22, and they were doing reds. And I'm sorry, barbiturates and alcohol is a good mix. I really like it. If you think a six-pack is really good, you should try, I don't know, let's say a six-pack and a couple of barbiturates. It's like we would go bowling, and I remember one time I got out of the car, and I looked up at the stars thinking, I'm going to go home. And it just went straight backwards, and I was just laying there. And I thought, I never want to leave here. I love it right here. So they just threw me in the car because I couldn't bowl anymore. And and then the end of the night, they got caught because they were trying to steal one of those ashtrays that have sand in it, and it fell all over the place in the bowling alley, and they got kicked out. And, you know, but that's how I grew up, and it was just the way that we drank. I mean, my dad grew up in a different time. He grew up in World War II, and then he went to the Korean War, and he was a prisoner of war, and he was there for 18 months. And when they came back, you know, men didn't talk about stuff. They just didn't talk about things, and they didn't talk about people dying and their friends that they left behind. But they drank, and they just drank, and that's how they survived, and that's how my father survived. And I believe that the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree. His father was an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. Ooh, I'm an alcoholic. What a no-brainer. You know, I mean, it just happens. You can either have the, I believe we either have the DNA, or if you drink enough, your body gets addicted to alcohol. And when you don't drink, you're going to start to have withdrawals. And that is called alcoholism. I believe that we do have an ism that I haven't drank for 27 years, but let me tell you, I still react alcoholically. Just ask my ex-husband who's here tonight. One of my girlfriend's friends, her husband's here tonight, and she says, you know, you may need to take 3 hours if your ex-husband is here. And I'm like, yeah, we could just go on for that for a while. But we got married in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we got divorced in Alcoholics Anonymous, and we are still friends today. How good of friends are we? We live together. I am from another planet. I don't know. Who does that? We are. It's very interesting. We'll get to that later. That's the last 15 minutes. So So I kept drinking, and I was in high school. I was a cheerleader. We drank all the time. We drank during football games. We were drunk half the time when we were cheerleading. During basketball games, I didn't really get basketball. I know they run up and down a court, and they put in the basket in here and there, but I really didn't get it. I'm like, it's just a bunch of guys running around, and why are there five? Why are there only five? Why can't you have 10? I don't get it, you know. But I was drinking through it, and so we would get really drunk, and people were wondering why we weren't cheering right, and that we were cheering at the wrong time, but we had a blast, you know. We were having the good time, and then we'd go down by the bay after the football games and the basketball games and the baseball games, and everybody would drink down at Fiesta Island and down around there, and then people would start fighting with other schools. I don't know why everybody hated Claremont High, but Madison hated us. PB hated us. Kearney hated us. Everybody hated us. I don't know why. Maybe because we were on the top of the hill and had a great view. I don't know why everybody hated Claremont, but they hated us, you know. So there were always fights, and I remember one incident. I was on gymnastics, and one of our girls was driving home one night with another girl, and they had gone to the Jack in the Box, and they were driving home on Marina, and her I think it was a shake or a Coke spilled over, and she went to reach for it, and the other girl in the car was killed, and it was just something that kind of changed us. She was just gone one day, and we didn't know how to process it, and it was very hard on, I know it was very hard on the girl that this happened to, but it was just something that we just didn't know how to deal with it. And so what we did is we just drank through things like that, and that set a precedent for me, that when I had feelings, I was just going to drink. I wasn't going to feel. I didn't like feeling. Feeling hurt. I didn't know how to hate my dad, but I hated him. So what I did is I drank. I didn't want to feel bad for hating him, so I drank to make that go away. And I went through to college. I went away I tried to get into San Diego State. I was a dancer for a couple of years, and I got on the dance team there. But when I went to school, they said, you didn't get accepted. Your grades weren't good enough. I'm like, what? Really? I'm like, I'm your dance team. I've already had my uniform and everything. And they go, well, if you were a minority a minority, you could get in. And I'm like, what? And I went into a funk. I went into like a 3-month depression, and that was really, really difficult. And I don't remember much about those 3 months. I remember that I barely got into Mesa, and I just had to, do that. And so I waited tables, going to school. I was drinking nights after. When you're a waitress, it's really easy to drink. And if you make friends with a bartender, it's even more easy to drink. They'll give you a Coke with a shot of tequila or whatever you drink in it, you know. And that's how I got by. I was drinking after work, and I went away to Mesa for a while, and then after Mesa, I did get accepted to a university up in Irvine, and I went away to fine arts school up in UCI Irvine, and I danced at Disneyland for a while. That was really fun. We used to dance drunk. I bet you never thought that of those people dancing down the street, but that's what we did. We used to go to, it was a 25th anniversary parade, and we would go, there's a place called Acapulco's that was down the street, and we had a 3 o'clock parade, and we'd get off, and then we'd go to there at 5 o'clock, and we'd drink for 2 hours, and then, please don't anybody call Disneyland. And then we'd come back, and we'd dance in parades, and, there was a couple of times, in high heels going down the street, there's that, that where that train goes down and everything, and I'd get my heel stuck, and I remember one time I was cussing up a storm. See, started at a young age. And said the F word. And they pulled me aside afterwards. And they go, Mickey does not cuss. Yes. And I'm like, really? And they're like, Mickey doesn't use any of those words. If you use that again, you will no longer be dancing at Disneyland. So I was like, okay, note to self. No F word while dancing down the street at Disneyland. But we just had a blast. It was the 80s. It was a great era. Madonna was going strong. We just had a really, really good time. It was just a really good time, and drinking wasn't a problem for me. It was more about fun. And, the three chapters that we talk about sometimes, in our drinking is it's a lot of fun. Then if there's some fun and there's some problems. And then it's all problems. And it kind of went that way for me. And it went kind of shortly, you know, soon after I was having some problems with my drinking where, you know, I was driving home and I don't remember driving home. And I was only sleeping all day and then I'd go to work and then I'd work all night and then I'd come home again and do the exact same thing over and over. And I don't know why I got to AA so soon. I don't know. When I was young, my mother took me to Alateen, and I would smoke pot out in the parking lot because I was like, "You're not getting my dad sober. If my dad's not sober, I'm not listening to you guys. Forget it. If you can't save my dad, then I'm not talking to you. I don't want this." And so we would sit out and smoke pot and stuff, and I'd come home stoned. And my mother, God love her, just let me be me. And she didn't try to change me. She would just tell me that she loved me. And I think the only reason why I'm here today is because my mother had that loving hand of God that she just said, "I love you." And so I had a little resentment against AA when I first came here because you didn't fix my dad. And I remember as a younger child, I made this little note to self, and this is what I said: "I will never, ever be an alcoholic, ever. Like my dad, ever, ever, ever." And I had that little promise that I was never going to be an alcoholic, ever. So when I started having problems, I didn't really connect anything. I thought, "I'm having problems and I don't get it. Why is the world turning against me? Why doesn't he like me? Why is this job firing me? Why is this? Why is that?" And I just didn't really get things. And then I got in a relation. I had totaled my car in 1983. I had pulled a muscle at Disneyland, and I wasn't working that Christmas. And there was this guy that I really loved at UCI Irvine, who I loved for so long. I loved him for 3 years, and then he finally asked me out on a date. So we went out on a date, and I got really drunk, really drunk. And then we went back to his house where a friend was, and they were smoking pot. And at some point, like in junior high, I stopped smoking pot because when I smoke pot, my eyes close. I could still be having a conversation with you, but you would think that I was asleep because my eyes would be closed. And I thought, this is not a good thing because I can't function if my eyes are closed. So I stopped smoking pot, and it was just drinking from that point on. I used other things the first time I did coke, I was like, "No, I'll never get enough of this. I'm not doing this." And I got in trouble the first time I did coke. I was like, "No, I don't like this either." And, you know, there's certain drugs that work for some people. That just wasn't for me. And I'm definitely not a crystal meth person. I would not put aluminum foil up on my windows. I'm not going to crawl on the ground to find little things that I could maybe burn in a toilet paper roll. I'm just not like that. I'm a drunk. I like what's in the bottle, and I just like that stuff. I know where I'm going. I'm going to sit on the couch, and I'm going to drink a lot, and I'm going to watch old movies and dance in my mind. Yeah, so I smoked a little bit of pot, and I said, "I got to go home." And then I felt completely out of control. "I got to go home now." And he goes, "You can't go home. You're too drunk." And I'm like, "Oh, yeah, I can. Watch me. I'm going to drive home." And so I lived in Corona Del Mar, and I tried to drive home, and I totaled my car. And I woke up, and the cops that came, they looked at the car, and they said, "Have you been drinking tonight?" And I said, "Well, I had a glass of wine, and I'm taking muscle relaxers because I pulled my groin." And they, you know, that was 83, so the cops drove me home. That's what they did in the 80s. You know, they ain't doing that now, just so you know. you're gonna get tested if you get stopped by a cop now and they think you're drinking. Things have changed a little bit, but just what's interesting is people are still dying of DUIs and car crashes. I happen to be an ER nurse now, and I see it all the time. I see the havoc that is, because of drinking and driving still. Innocent people die a lot, and then just people that miss the mark, and they, you know, they're probably good people. They just, you know, thought tonight was the night that they could drive home drunk, and they don't come in with all their body parts. So I totaled my car that night, and the next morning I woke up and I was just devastated. I thought I could have killed somebody. You know, I could have crossed that line and I could have hit somebody head on. So I tried to stop drinking for a month and it didn't last. I had a roommate that I had taken to a 12-step meeting because I had been in another 12-step recovery program, and took her to an Overeaters Anonymous meeting, and she got clean and sober that night. And so she talked to me, this was like a little while later, about a year later, and she had said, you know, maybe you have a problem with drinking. And I'm like, really? Because, you know, I took you to your first meeting. I don't have a problem. You know, that's not my problem. You know, I just overshot the mark, and I am never going to be an alcoholic. My father was an alcoholic. I'm not going to be an alcoholic. And so that's how my rational went. And that year, I got into a relationship with somebody at work. There's a reason why they say don't dip your pen in company ink. And definitely if you're a waitress, don't sleep with a bartender or a cook. This will make your life really unmanageable once you break up. You won't get your food for an hour, and they will make your life a living hell. So I dated this guy, and it didn't work out. He forgot to tell me that he was married, and that he was separated, though, but he had two kids. And right there, I'm just not that type of gal. I mean, my mother did raise me a little bit right. And, you know, you just don't date married men. It's just not my deal. I just don't do that stuff. And, you know, so we were having some problems in our relationship. Well, one, he was doing coke, and I was drinking, so I was passed out most of the time. And, you know, there's things I don't like to say from the podium, but I only say it because I hope it helps another alcoholic woman. And one night he was having a party at his house, and I just got really, really drunk and went in the bedroom. And the next thing I know, things are happening to me without my permission. And if you're a female that's been, things happen to us when we're drinking. Sometimes things happen to us when we're drinking because we can't protect ourselves. If you try to hurt me today, it's going to be you or me. I can protect myself. I know how to do that today. But I couldn't do it on that. And I was so humiliated that I crawled out of the house the next morning. And I came back a couple of days later and I said, listen, either you stop using or I can't stay in this relationship. And he said, that's the door. And there was something inside me, this little girl that was about six or seven, I don't know, this little child inside of me, something broke. And something said, you know what, you're not worth anything. Your dad didn't love you. Oh, I'm so sorry. Your dad didn't love you, and no one else is ever going to love you, and you're not good enough. And something inside me broke, and I went up to, we were going to go away on vacation, of course, which I was paying for. And I went away to Santa Barbara, went to a really nice hotel. I used to work for the Marriott. I've worked for so many hotels, and they give you, when you work for them, you can go to any one of their sites and pay, I don't know, $30 a night. So I went to the Santa Barbara Biltmore, which was absolutely beautiful and stunning, and stayed in the hotel and got drunk every single day. And I could rent a little bike, and it had that little basket on the front, and I'd ride into town, into Santa Barbara, and I'd get like three bottles of wine, and then I'd ride back to the hotel and drink all night in the hotel room. It was just, it was pathetic. The best vacation in the world, but pathetic, you know? And then I came back to back down to Corona Del Mar, and it was in that time that I continued to drink, but something, I was drinking in my room all the time after work. I'd come home and I'd be crying and drinking. And I remember one night I said, God, please help me. And it was a couple of months, but I started going to therapy probably about February, March, something like that. And when I went into therapy, I was talking to her about my life, about this and why I have these problems and why men don't love me and la, la, la. And she said, you might want to try to stop drinking. And I said, what? I said, I just paid you $90 to tell me not to drink that. Did you not listen to me? This is what's going on. This is the guy, the work, this, school. It didn't work out. I'm not Katherine Hepburn. And I just went, you know, and she said, why don't we just try to not drink for a little bit? Why don't we try 30 days? Just let's see if we can. I said, I've done that before. It didn't work. And she goes, why don't we just try? And, you know, her name was Stephanie, and I really have to say that I think one of the reasons why I'm sober today is because a therapist said maybe you have a problem with alcohol. And so I stopped drinking for 30 days, and I found out how I didn't know how to be among you without alcohol. It had become my best friend. It was the one equalizer that when I would go out with people drinking, I don't know if you're like that, but I'd sit on a bar stool, and I'd look over here, and I'd go, I'm never going to get that guy, never. And then I'd look over here and go, oh, I'm so much better than her. Jesus, what is she doing? You know, and that's how my mind was. I lived on a teeter-totter that it was so far out there that I couldn't do either of those. You know, it was just insanity. And I was the type of drunk, I don't know if any of you are like this also, One guy cut me off one day. I followed him home. And when he got out of his car, I got out of my car. And I said, do you know you cut me off back there? And the look in his face was like, she's crazy. I'm going to get in my house. And I kind of overstepped the mark a little bit. And that's how I am. I mean, I was not real put together when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And I started going to meetings. The first women's meeting that I went to, or the first AA meeting that I went to when I was really serious about getting sober, it was a gay meeting up in Corona Del Mar. I raised my hand and I said, I think I have a problem with drinking. And I just started crying. And they came up to me afterwards and they gave me their numbers. I didn't really like connect with anybody, but they gave me their numbers and I felt welcome. And I started going to meetings. And this, I was a waitress at night, so I worked 5 nights a week. And I went to this young people's meeting down in Laguna, and I sat next to this guy who happened to be really cute. And he said, well, how many meetings do you go to? And I go, well, I go to about 2 a week. And he goes, well, you're going to drink again if you don't start going to more meetings. And I was like, you know how you just shut down? Like somebody just said something to you that just makes you shut down. And I completely shut down. And I went home. And like any good person that drinks, you have to have alcohol in your house. Because why? You never know if somebody's going to come over and you need to be a good hostess and offer them a glass of wine or a beer. So all night I got up and I went and I looked in the refrigerator and I just said, not tonight. Don't drink tonight. And I would get up like 20, 30 minutes later and I'd go look at it again. And I'd say, no, not tonight. We're not drinking tonight. Just don't drink no matter what. And that next morning, I went to a 7 a.m. meeting down on the peninsula, the Lano Club, and I went to that meeting at 7 a.m. for the rest of the year, and I took my first-year birthday cake there. And in that first year, I learned a lot about Alcoholics Anonymous. I learned about service. They told me to, you know, do that. We used to get to smoke in meetings in those days. Those were the good old days. And they would put they had this side of the room and that side of the room, and they'd put an ashtray on every other seat, and I was in charge of the ashtrays, and somebody would come, and they'd move the ashtrays, and I'd go, you can't move the ashtrays. There's supposed to be one on every other seat, and that's how we have it. And they kind of would go, oh, this one's a little tightly wrapped, you know, and they just said, you just keep coming back. And so, you know, and then I graduated to, you know, doing the coffee, you know, the little coffee cups. And we used to have porcelain coffee cups in the club. And the people would come over and they'd put it down. And there's a sink right there that you would pour out the remainder of the coffee and then put the coffee cup there. And people wouldn't do that. So I'd go over and go, you didn't pour out all your coffee. You need to pour out all your coffee because that's what we do here. And they just go, you just keep coming back. You're doing a really, really good job, you know. And then I got to be secretary at that meeting, and it was just, you know, you learn a lot in your first year of sobriety. I think if you can stay sober for a year, you can stay sober for a long, long time. And they told me, we don't drink no matter what, and you go to meetings and you don't drink in between meetings. And I heard them. I listened to them. I really was about ready to die. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was so numb. I was walking around in sweats. I wouldn't let you talk to me. I was so hurt as a, you know, like you, how you're wounded. It's like sometimes you're just so wounded that if anybody touches you, you're going to crack. And that's how I felt. And I just didn't want anybody to get close to me. If you were a guy and you came over and you said hi to me, oh, that was not the good thing to do, because then I would tell you what I can't cuss, you were. And, you know, it was just like I took a really long time. I didn't even hug a guy for probably 3 years in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I finally started to feel safe. I finally started to feel like I could protect myself and I could take care of myself. I didn't even date in Alcoholics Anonymous for 16 years. So it was a really long time before I felt safe. And it was a real, you know, we learn things here. You know, I can't teach you, if you're new today, I cannot give you, you know, 12 years of sobriety. You just got to go through your first year. And you will learn so much in your first year, and it just keeps going. You know, I can't, it's just like we just keep plugging along. I believe, like, I really love the big books of Alcoholics Anonymous. I believe that it was divinely inspired. I believe that these two guys, in their own best way, probably would have messed up everything, but somewhere along the way, one guy talking to another guy, something, God was throwing the dice in their favor, and he said, you know what, you guys are doing a good thing, I'm here with you, don't worry about it. And if you're new, they did not have a book when AA first started. They had what was called the Oxford group that kind of came out of the Washingtonians. There were some people that started something and then they defunct. And then the Oxford group got together. And then after a short time, they defunct. And did they defunct because they got religion involved? I don't know. But I believe that's probably what happened. I believe that there were people that are like, you know, you got to be Methodist. No, you got to be Presbyterian. No, you got to be Lutheran. And things just defunct. And then people couldn't get sober. And then when we talk about Carl Jung, who helped Ebby, Roland, and Roland helped Ebby, and Ebby lit, you know, Bill W. on fire, and Bill W. was just about ready to drink, but he looked at a telephone on a wall in Akron, and he started looking up some churches and thought, maybe I could help another alcoholic, and there just happened to be this guy named Dr. Bob, and Dr. Bob was on a bender, you know, and he went over the, you know, and talked to him the next day and told him how he got sober, and then it got going, and that was out without the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. So what we can learn from them is those first 100 people, they sat around in meetings and they shared their first step. And they told people how they drank, what happened, and what it's like now. I don't know how important God was in those days because I wasn't there. But I do believe that they tried to help another alcoholic. If you try to help another alcoholic, the chances of you staying sober for a long time is very, very good. That's what we're supposed to do. We just try to help another individual. And I kind of opened my world a little bit now. I believe that, you know, AA says to enlarge on my spiritual life. I do go to church. I don't get to go to church every weekend because I work every other weekend. But I do go to church, and I try to do with the values that they teach me. And my church says do all the good you can at all the time you can in all the ways you can to all the people you can for as long as you can. That's the deal. That's what we're doing in here. It says to be of maximum service to God and my fellow man. Well, who's my fellow man? Is it just alcoholics? No. Today I went walking around Balboa Park because I was taking my dog for a walk, and I saw a homeless guy, and as I was walking by, you know, head hang low, not looking at me in the eyes, and I said, hey, how are you today? And he just kind of nodded, and I said, you getting on? And he goes, you know, and that's the nice thing that we can do for another human being. I saw some people giving food to the homeless. They just had wrapped boxes that they were giving food out. Hey, if I can do that and be like that, I'm doing well. I mean, that's what we're supposed to do. I didn't get sober to be a jerk. I didn't get sober to be all about me. What did I get today? Did I buy myself an outfit today? You know, what am I going to get? Is my ring big enough? That's not what we get sober for. We get sober so that we can live a reasonably happy life. If I get cancer, I get cancer. It's not God doing it to me. It's the luck of the draw. You know, because I know right now, as I'm sitting here, there is a little kid in Africa that's dying of AIDS, that his mother and father have already died. They don't have medication for him, and he will suffer a horrible death. And why? Just because he was born in another country. That's just the way that the thing goes, and that's the way that the earth turns. And, you know, we're supposed to be loving and kind to each other. And sometimes in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, it really frustrates me when somebody new comes in that may be drunk and somebody tries to kick them out. That's not what we're supposed to be doing. We're supposed to be going over, giving them a cup of coffee and sitting on them and not telling, you know, just sitting on them so they don't get up and share. You know? Listen, I've told people when they get up and they start talking and they're drunk, I'm like, you have nothing that we need. We know that you're drunk. You don't have the solution. Why don't you sit down and listen to the people that have the solution? Because we're doing it. You're not. You're drunk. And I, you know, today one of the things that I get to do is I work in an ER, and I had three people last night. Out of the eight people that I usually get during the day, three of them have to do with drugs and alcohol. They're either med-seeking. They're either coming in because they're withdrawing from drugs or alcohol. They're either coming in that they were found down because they're so drunk and they can't protect their airway. Maybe it's their first time out of the gate. I get 13-year-olds all the time that they're drunk for the first time and they're peeing all over themselves, and you know the parents are all you know hysterical. And I said, you know what, this is just something that's normal for a 13-year-old, but if they do it again, get involved, because that means they're starting a little road of what is alcoholism, that I know to be alcoholism. And I believe that if you're in an ER, you're in an institution. That is a medical institution, and now you're doing institutions. Maybe you haven't done a DUI and got in jail, but now you're doing institutions. And the thing that's around the corner is death. People die all the time of this disease. You know, they die young, they die old. You know, this last month was an interesting month. We had a 26-year-old that blew his brains out. We had a 22-year-old that overdosed on heroin. This disease is a killer. It's taken them out. It's taken them out, old and young. And I think that what I can do today is I just try to be sober. I just try to be sober. And the guy that I was sharing with last night, he comes in multiple times, and I sat down and I said, "What do you want from us?" And he goes, "I just want some Librium." And I go, "Well, what do you want to do about your alcoholism, because it's killing you?" And you know, and I told him what they told me in here. I said, "Is what you're doing working for you?" He can't defend that. He's on a gurney, drunk. What he's doing isn't working for him. And this is the two things they always tell me. "I don't want to do God. I don't like God. I'm not talking to God." I said, "You don't have to do that. No one's asking you to do that. We're just asking you not to drink for 24 hours. Don't worry about that. That's concepts that we don't understand. You just need to stop drinking. And maybe if you stop drinking, you may get happy. You may not even need to be here on a gurney because you're happy, joyous, and free. Trust us. Trust good, orderly direction. Trust group of drunks. That's what we're doing. I didn't get a God for a long, long time. I had a God before, but my God was really immature and not very good. I had the parking God. If I didn't get the parking spot, God didn't love me for the day. You know, if I didn't get the guy that I wanted, God didn't like me. You know, that's not my God today. God, I go out in my backyard a lot, don't I, Danny? My cats have overtaken my life. I rescued a dog last year, and now it's all about the dog getting a walk and the cats getting outside. And that's where I spend most of my time when I'm not at work. But I go outside and I watch my cats, and my cats just love the world. Everything's so exciting. A butterfly sitting under a tree, the wind in their face. You know, it's just they appreciate the moment. And if I could get like that, if I could get where I just appreciate the moment every single day, and that I'm able to share with another human being what I have found life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I have found a way of living that supersedes anything. I have been rocketed to a fourth dimension. One of the doctors, we have a love-hate relationship, he calls me the drunk whisperer. And he goes, "Would you go down to talk to bed 7? And I'm like, "I'll go in." And I'm telling you, if they start giving me excuses, they don't want what we have. I say, "You probably don't want to get sober." I said, "But if you do want anything, just let me know. I'll give you my telephone number and I'll take you to a meeting." And that's what I try to do with them. There's a huge epidemic out there. We are just skimming the surface. If you don't believe that, go to downtown tonight and just walk around a couple of corners around, let's say, 11th and Island. And I'll tell you, people are dying of this disease. And, you know, I don't know the way that they were raised. They probably come from very poor childhoods where maybe somebody was molested or raped or beaten. I don't know. But I know that drinking is a solution to that type of insanity. And so oftentimes people have these drinking problems due to that. The one thing that I do want to share is that relationships get mended. I know you're going to kill me because I didn't go over the steps. The steps are there. Read them. What it used to be like, what happened, what it's like now. Me and my father had a really bad relationship, and in AA I had to do a 4-step, and in my 4-step I realized that I had to make amends to my father, and I went to my father and we had never said I love you, ever. And I was old now. I was like, you know, 20, 28, 29, maybe 27, 28. And I went to him and I said, "You know what? I really want to apologize to you. I was not the easiest kid to have. I was very hard on you, and I didn't love you for just you. And I'm sorry that I expected you to be something other than you were. And I appreciate that you were my dad, and I don't want anybody other to be my dad." My dad had stopped drinking years before, but he still was kind of angry. My dad, you know, he'd went to AA for 2 years, but then he stopped going. And I remember one time we got in an argument, and I said, "Didn't you ever read the Big Book?" And he was like, "Sometimes the Big Book lies." And I just knew that that was the road that my dad decided to take. And my job was not to judge him, but just to love him. And my sponsor said to me at the time, "Every time you see your dad, I want you to go up and tell him that you love him and give him a kiss." The first time I did that, I could not do it. I walked out of the house and I started crying. I couldn't do it. And the next time I started, I could. And it got a little bit easier and a little bit easier and a little bit easier. 2 years ago, my dad, he had COPD really, really bad, and he was deteriorating, and he fell and he broke 3 ribs, and I knew he was going to be dead within a week. So we brought him home from Balboa, and I happened to have that weekend off. I would have taken it off anyways. I got to stay with him, until he died. And my mother and my brother and I were all there, and we held his hand. And there's nothing more spiritual than birth than death. And when you get to be with somebody that when they're going out, in that spiritual moment when they take their last breath, and I told him that I loved him. I told him that he didn't owe me anything, and I didn't owe him anything, and that I'll see him on the other side. And I really felt that. And I'm at peace with my father, and I do miss him sometimes. He's buried out at Fort Rosecrans, and so I do get to go out and see him sometimes and have the wind in my hair and just know that he's swinging now. He's doing the swing up and wherever he's at, the spirit world, that he's doing the swing, and he's doing well. So if you have a problem with drinking, AA does have a solution that will fit anybody's I don't want to say anybody's box, because then that sounds bad. Wouldn't you know a girl would say that? Fit anybody's mind. Anything that you can wrap your mind around, we have something for you. We don't ask you to do anything but not drink for 24 hours. And in that, you will find the absolute freedom. I can go anywhere. I could tell the President of the United States, although I'd adore him, I do. I can tell him if I don't agree with him. I can tell my boss at work, I don't agree with you. I think I can say anything. Now, there's ramifications that you have to take responsibility for what you say. And I do. Sometimes I could get fired for what I say sometimes. And I have to take responsibility for that. But I've learned to be an adult in AA. I have learned that if I get fired, I look for a job. I learned that if I have bills to pay, I work harder. I learned that if I need to spend less, then that's what I do, although my ex-husband wouldn't say that. But we're doing okay. We're him and I are just trying to help each other out through a tough time, because it is a tough time right now in the world. People are having a hard time getting by. And so if you, anything out of this talk, if you could, help another alcoholic, we, recovery homes, there are more people than there are recovery homes. There will always be more people suffering there than there will be beds. And in the olden days, people used to take alcoholics in and give them a couch for a month. We're not doing that much anymore. And so these people don't have a place to go. And Maslow's hierarchy, if you don't have a place to sleep for the night, it's very hard for you to even think about getting sober. So there is work for us to do. And I really appreciate you letting me come out tonight. I wish you well on your journey. My name is Melody. And if you ever need any help, let me know. Bye.